as they do this business, they can run it as a business, get loans from banks, and put the revenue back into the banks as every other business does.
Congressman Young advocates for states' rights as part of the Cannabis Caucus. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a proposal for a state income tax on lobbyists.
We've actually, because of budget cuts, lost two lobbying staff people in Juneau, and so this would be trying to bring some support back.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Alaska Congressman Don Young says he's never smoked marijuana, but recognizing that his constituents have voted to legalize it, Young says he wants to change federal law to help marijuana entrepreneurs do business. As APRN Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, the pot issue has Young joining forces with congressmen of different stripes.
They call themselves the Cannabis Caucus, two Republicans and two Democrats in the U.S. House who want to ease federal restrictions on marijuana. Young says one of his top concerns is that marijuana retailers can't use banks. He says cash attracts trouble.
And my goal is to make sure that if I am in the business, like we have quite a few in Alaska now, as they do this business, they can run it as a business, get loans from banks, and put the revenue back into the banks as every other business does.
Representative Earl Blumenauer says another goal is to make federal tax code fair for cannabis businesses.
They cannot, because of a provision called 280E, fully deduct their business expenses, requiring a much higher effective tax rate, and they have to pay those unfair taxes with cash because of the banking prohibition, which is insane.
The four lawmakers who founded this new caucus make for an odd lot. Blumenauer, a Democrat from Portland, is prone to bow ties and zealous about bicycle commuting. He's been working to legalize marijuana since the 1970s. Republican Dana Rohrabacher represents Orange County and some of the most conservative cities of California. He preaches the benefits of medical marijuana. He says someone gave him a cannabis-infused candle when he was suffering from shoulder trouble.
And I put it on my arm, and guess what? The pain went away for a couple hours, and I got sleep for the first time in weeks.
Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, a Democrat from Boulder, is socially liberal and a champion of his state's highly developed marijuana industry. And then there's Young, the longest-serving Republican in Congress.
I'm here primarily. I'm a conservative Republican, but I believe in states' rights.
To illustrate the odd politics of it, Young said Polis just this week accused him of being a puppy killer. No, Polis said.
I definitely didn't accuse you, Mr. Young, of being a puppy killer. I said the bill was a puppy-killing bill.
That was Young's bill to strike an Obama administration ban on predator hunting methods on national wildlife refuges, which the House just passed. It's unclear how many others will join the new cannabis caucus. This is a time of uncertainty for marijuana. More and more states are voting to legalize it, but the new administration could choose to enforce federal law more vigorously than the last. The new Attorney General, former U.S. Senator Jeff Sessions, sounded like a marijuana foe at a hearing just last year.
I mean, we need grown-ups in charge in Washington to say marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized. It ought not to be minimized, that it's in fact a very real danger.
Young says he's ready to butt heads with the Attorney General if he has to. But Young and the rest of the Cannabis Caucus say they hope to achieve reforms in law so marijuana policy isn't subject to an AG's whim. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
As you just heard in that story, the U.S. House today approved a bill to lift Obama administration restrictions on hunting and trapping of bears, wolves, and other predators on federal wildlife refuges in Alaska. The Fish and Wildlife Service said last year the rule will help maintain sustainable populations of bears, wolves, and coyotes on national wildlife refuges across the state. Alaska Congressman Don Young says the rule undermines Alaska's ability to manage wildlife on refuge land, one-fifth of its land mass. He says the regulation violates the Statehood Act, which gives Alaska the right to manage fish and game. The Humane Society of the United States has been running ads against Young's repeal bill. They say the rule prevents animal cruelty by banning practices such as killing bears and wolves in their dens and using large leg-hold traps. The measure was approved on a 225 to 193 vote. It now goes to the Senate. Governor Bill Walker took action this week to try to stem the epidemic of overdose deaths from heroin and other opioid drugs. Walker signed a disaster declaration that's intended to make it easier to give overdose victims the life-saving antidote naloxone. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the declaration.
More than 100 Alaskans have died from opioid overdoses over the last 3 years. Governor Bill Walker says declaring a disaster will enable a coordinated statewide response.
I mean, it's not one particular region, one particular income strata. It is widespread. And it's just the stories are just horrific from across the state.
Walker ordered state agencies Thursday to apply for grants to prevent and treat addiction. They'll also work to eliminate illegally imported drugs and help monitor controlled drugs. And they'll aim to add funding for treatment using methadone and other medications. State Chief Medical Officer Dr. Jay Butler is leading a weekly in-state command system of senior state officials to respond to the epidemic, similar to the response to oil spills and other disasters.
The challenge of the opioid epidemic is that it's more than just a criminal justice issue, but it's also a health issue. And we need to address it very broadly in terms of being a health issue, a public safety issue, an education issue, a medical practice issue. We need to have a multi-pronged approach.
Butler says making naloxone more widely available is an important first step, but he says it's important to transition those recovering from overdoses into withdrawal and addiction treatment.
It's not a cure-all. It's like a tourniquet in a severe trauma case. It saves a life, but it does not cure addiction. And so that's why a much broader-based approach is needed.
The state will spend more than $4 million on the effort. All of the funding comes from four federal grants. Butler says more doctors should receive training to provide patients with methadone and other drugs that help treat addiction, including Vivitrol and buprenorphine.
Many of my colleagues I'll hear say, well, I didn't really go into medicine to treat addiction, but I think we all went into medicine to make people well.
A key part of the opioid response is the people in recovery who work as peer counselors. They connect those who are using heroin and other drugs with the treatment they need. Juneau resident Karen Nelson is a certified recovery and reentry coach. She directs Haven House Juneau, a peer-led, faith-based transitional home for women leaving prison. She praises Walker's approach.
I think it's just going to give us more ammo when we're trying to fight to bring different supports and say we need more treatment, we need more detox, we need to treat this as a public health issue. And what that means is long-term recovery supports, which we are lacking so much here in the state.
Walker says he'll work with the legislature for changes to state law to aid the effort. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Juneau Democrat Representative Sam Keto III wants to close a $200,000 funding gap at the Alaska Public Offices Commission, or APOC, which oversees the activity of candidates, political groups, and lobbyists. His solution, a selective income tax on lobbyists. The revenue, he says, would help with accurate and timely oversight of lobbying activities.
Over the recent couple of years, we've actually, because of budget cuts, lost two lobbying staff people in Juneau that were overseeing the lobbying program. And so this would be trying to bring some support back.
In 2016, the state increased the amount that APOC can collect through fees to make up for budget cuts. But APOC doesn't have the legal standing, called a receipt authority, to raise the funds. Keto wants to replace the $250 registration fee that lobbyists currently pay per contract with a 2.5% income tax on lobbyists. The tax would allow APOC to meet its receipt authority and provide some extra revenue for hiring staff. In a hearing on February 14th, Heather Hebden, who directs APOC, says the tax would apply to approximately 132 registered lobbyists in the state. The bill is stuck in the House State Affairs Committee. Representative Chris Birch, who sits on the committee, doesn't like levying a tax on a specific profession.
I would be much more comfortable to retain some sort of a flat rate. I think that's a much more manageable approach than instituting an income tax on the lobbyists, and certainly more consistent with what I would see as fair and equitable.
Keto, a former lobbyist himself, admits that Alaska's constitution, which prohibits earmarking revenue for specific purposes, presents a problem for the bill in its current form.
There is not a way to clearly identify that the lobbyist tax revenue will directly benefit the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Keto says he's open to changes to the bill that would ensure more funding for APOC. The bill has not been scheduled for another hearing. There is a committee substitute in the works. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the hard work and satisfaction of being a dog handler.
It's been 100% about investing in an experience I'll be talking about and thinking about and drawing from for the rest of my life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Ketchikan Airport has one, so does the Walter Soboloff Building in downtown Juneau. Now a fringe group of homeowners are installing wood pellet boilers to heat their homes. Not to be confused with wood-burning stoves, these boilers have been marketed as a cheaper alternative to heating oil, at least in the long run. But is the framework there to make the technology go mainstream? From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Crystal Higdon takes me downstairs to her garage, where her family recently had a reason to celebrate.
So it's a whole house system.
They completed the installation of a new wood pellet boiler. So when the moment came to hit the switch after a year of anticipation, Higdon says they didn't pop open champagne, but they did make brownies.
Invited the electrician and the plumber and everybody over, made a crock pot of chili and just had a big party that we were firing it up.
Higdon is one of about four homeowners in Juneau who have made the transition from electric resistance heat or oil to a wood pellet boiler. It works like this. The pellets ignite, and that heat is transferred through pipes of water around the home. The boilers can run about $12,000 just for the equipment itself. Not included in that price is the installation, inspection, and upgrades needed. But Higdon says for her family, it seemed worth the initial investment.
It just felt right for us to kind of move away from the dependence on oil wherever we could. And the timing was right to have to replace our boiler. And so we were looking at options of, you know, some kind of renewable energy that we could use.
Whether or not wood pellet boilers are a renewable form of energy is debated, especially when the pellets have to be shipped from someplace else. Still, Higdon says her reasons for wanting it were practical, as well as environmental. She learned about the system through word of mouth. And with any emerging technology, she says they've run into a few surprises.
Well, we had to, find someone who was willing to install it without, you know, maybe knowing how.
And now there's another hoop to jump through, building a wood pellet shed. It's not a necessity, but it would make it easier for Higdon's family. They would only have to fill it up about once a year. The shed has special dimensions and a slope floor which feeds the boiler.
So the folks in town that we contacted, several contractors, had never built anything like that.
We were listening. She came at the right time. We were trying to figure out what type of project we wanted to do.
That's Justin Fantasia, and he's talking about his students. He's a faculty member at the University of Alaska Southeast and teaches construction technology. He says, although it's a unique arrangement, his class sometimes partners with people. Higdon is paying for the materials, but Fantasia's spring semester will be building the pellet shed. He says the main focus is to swing a hammer and to see a project through from start to finish. Last semester, they built a tiny house.
We don't want to be trendy, but we want to pay attention to what people are excited about.
And for the time being, that seems like it could be wood pellet boilers. Fantasia says the university would consider teaching a class on the installation, if there was interest.
Construction technology changes super fast. Everybody who's been alive for 10 years or more probably has seen new building products come on the market, new techniques, new concerns with changing costs of oil, hopefully going up for at least the state's reason.
Oil prices are going up, but the overall price of heating fuel is cheaper than it's been in the past. Higdon thinks her wood pellet boiler will eventually pencil out in the next 4 years. In the meantime, as she waits for the shed, she's keeping the golden pellets of Douglas fir in a gray plastic bucket. Right now, her family buys them in bulk at Home Depot, shipped from Oregon. There's a business in Ketchikan that makes wood pellets, but there's not a bulk delivery system yet. Higdon says, living in the Tongass, she would prefer to buy local.
I would, yeah. And so if that's available in the future, you know, we're hoping that there's enough demand that is created by people installing them that something like that could happen for Juneau.
The regional native corporation, Sea Alaska, outfitted its headquarters with a wood pellet boiler. And about 2 years ago, it added another when it opened the Walter Soboleff building. In the past, the corporation has shown interest in developing the wood pellet market in Southeast by creating demand. But as of now, the pellets they're using come from Washington State and British Columbia. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
During a normal winter, sea ice grows quickly in the Arctic Ocean, filling up nearly the entire ocean basin. This year, though, warm weather and storms are keeping the sea ice extent at record lows. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with climatologist Brian Brettschneider each week as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. Brettschneider says Arctic sea ice is in pretty sad shape.
Most of the last, say, 200 days, the sea ice has achieved a daily record low. So even though it's still kind of midwinter or late winter up there, we should expect a lot of growth, and we really haven't seen nearly as much as we would expect given the time of year.
Why have we been seeing such slow ice growth this winter?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Most importantly, it's been very, very warm in the high Arctic. I mean, there's been times where even at the North Pole, it's hit at or above freezing, which is almost unheard of. So we've had this confluence of very, very warm temperatures, which obviously slows down sea ice growth. We've also had a lot of stormy conditions, particularly over, you know, around Iceland and north of Scandinavia, that have promoted a lot of wave action. So just a lot of things have kind of come together to really slow and even at times to reverse the sea ice growth in winter, which again is pretty unprecedented.
Why does winter sea ice in the Arctic matter?
You know, you have to build up a lot of sea ice in the winter and maximize that extent before the melt season starts. And hopefully you've built up enough so that when the melt season comes, you have a lot of buffer. You have a lot of ice there, first year ice particularly, that can melt away to kind of protect the old ice. When you start off with such a low baseline, the melt season can be really hard on that ice and it can really accelerate. So you need that winter growth to offset that summer melt.
So when you're looking at these figures, how alarming is it?
It is pretty alarming. At times there's been open water not far off the North Slope of Alaska in January and February, which is really astonishing. Over to the east of Greenland, like around the Svalbard Islands of Norway, I don't think they've had any sea ice, and they've been above freezing. I mean, these are areas that should be locked into ice and should be below zero. So it's very, very concerning about where we might end up in the summer melt season.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical cost. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The top rookie in this year's UConn Quest crossed the finish line in Fairbanks yesterday. Catherine Keith of Kotzebue arrived just before noon on Wednesday with 10 dogs to claim Rookie of the Year honors. Keith has run the Iditarod three times, but this was her first UConn Quest.
It was much more challenging than my expectations, to be honest. So it really lived up to its reputation. I feel a lot tougher having finished.
Keith shares dogs with fiancé Iditarod champion John Baker. While her team is used to cold weather, she says the many summits along the Quest Trail were a new challenge.
This is a tough group of dogs coming out from Kotzebue, where there's no hills, and then coming out here and really learning how to pull up the hills.
Keith was followed across the Quest finish line yesterday afternoon by Jesse Royer and Ryan Olson in the 8th and 9th place. The last five mushers in this year's UConn Quest are expected in Fairbanks today and tomorrow. Behind many of the world's top mushing champions is an army of cheap, semi-skilled labor. Dog handlers. Across Alaska, handlers play a pivotal role. They manage sprawling kennels and help train sled dogs for competition. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes has more.
Inside a cold, dim room, Tara Cicatello stirs a bucket of frothy brown liquid.
I am making dog food.
It's a mix of kibble and frozen meat that's been thawed into a soupy kind of gruel. Cicatello grabs a heavy bucket in each one of her hands, trundles out to the dog yard, and starts slopping food into bowls.
Hey, buddy. Here's some supper.
Cicatello is in charge of feeding 25 dogs twice a day. After they eat, she retraces her steps, scooping away piles of poop.
Literally, I just take the sled in one hand, the shovel in the other, and I just knock it out.
The whole routine takes about an hour. Most of the time, it's in the dark, under a headlamp, and there are no days off, even when it's 50 below. This is the less glamorous side of dog mushing. Cicatello is a handler for a relatively new musher, Kristen Bacon, who finished her first Iditarod last year. This season, Bacon's training out of champion musher Jeff King's Husky Homestead, north of Cantwell. Cicatello stays in a small apartment on the property and gets a modest monthly stipend. In exchange, she does everything from feedings to practice runs to mushing the dogs and mid-distance races, one of which the two women are getting ready for now. Bacon is sitting on the floor, plotting where they'll rest.
Remember that you need to think about Tal Vista to Deshka Landing is 75 miles, and whether you really want to run a 75-mile run or you're going to have a little nap.
These logistics are complex, sort of like planning a multi-day camping trip spread out over 200 miles, but also with a pack of animals attached by ropes. They're assembling drop bags with all the supplies they'll need, from food to overstuffed Ziplocs full of dog booties, color-coordinated to match each animal's paw size.
Libby red, Yama orange, Skeeter red.
This is where good help makes a huge difference. Orange. Bacon needs a lot from her handler, particularly because she's not a professional musher and still has to work a job to pay her bills. She's a physical therapist for kids and regularly travels to small communities far away from her kennel. And when she's gone, she needs Cicatello not just to dog sit, but to put miles on her team for serious races.
I either need to pay to have really good help here with my dogs and trust that whoever's here taking care of them and feeding them is doing an appropriate job so that I can go work.
For handlers, though, the economic logic is less conventional. The arrangement falls somewhere between an apprenticeship and indentured servitude. Handlers are subject to the same state labor laws and minimum wage standards as other employees, but a director with the Department of Labor says hardly any claims are reported to the state about labor abuse in the mushing industry. And for Cicatello, the grit itself is a selling point.
I love adventure and I love going out and doing things, and so
to me, just like sitting in office all day was not fulfilling.
Cicatello graduated a few years ago with an English degree from a college in upstate New York, where she grew up. She got her start mushing when she lived in Nome, where, full disclosure, we were briefly roommates and stayed in touch. Handling dogs is a bit of a career gamble for her, if she ever decides to leave the mushing world.
I wish I could tell you I had, like, long-term life plan plans, but I'm really bad at making those. So far, I've been living my life season to season.
In some ways, mushing is highly specialized labor, but Cicatello doesn't feel like she's cutting herself off from other work opportunities. She's just 25 years old and has had enough odd and seasonal jobs that she's not really worried about finding other work if she needs to. And you don't get into mushing to make money. That's something I heard from other handlers too, including Sean Underwood, who moved up from Georgia to commercial fish and stuck around Alaska when he got the chance to handle for Jeff King.
I graduated with a degree in economics, minored in Spanish, and now I'm just running a 12-dog team, so I don't know where the supply and demand chart for economics comes into play there.
Underwood is excited but a little nervous as he gets ready to run the same race as Cicatello. Except for him, this is his first time ever competing on a sled. He never expected to be in this position. Back in Atlanta, he was a hotel valet and substitute Spanish teacher. He likes this better. Even though financially he's just breaking even, he still thinks of this as a deposit toward his future.
You know, if I'm not saving for retirement at 25 right now, I'm not super worried about it. For now, it's been 100% about investing in it, in an experience and doing something that I'll be talking about and thinking about and drawing from for the rest of my life.
In this calculus, adventure is the profit. I follow up with Cicatello by phone about how the race went.
Hello.
She came in 17th, three spots behind Underwood. Although, in her defense,
he was running just 18.
Still, Cicatello now has enough race miles to be qualified for next year's Iditarod, if she chooses to stick around. In Denali, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
For more coverage of all things mushing, you can subscribe to the Iditapod, a podcast about the Iditarod from Alaska Public Media and our partners at KNOM Radio in Nome. The first episodes are available now on our website, iTunes, or Stitcher. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Caroline Halter, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Molly Reddick in Fairbanks, and Annie Feit and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Join Alaskan leaders for an online discussion about civility in the last frontier Thursday, February 23rd from 5:30 to 7 at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast. If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.